This month, the National Book Awards will announce this year's winners. And among the finalists is Jacqueline Woodson's novel, Another Brooklyn. It's her first new adult novel in decades, though you might remember that she won a National Book Award for her young adult memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. This new novel is the story of a friendship among four girls in the Bushwick neighborhood in the 1970s. That's where Woodson herself grew up. She told Steve Paulson that this kind of black girl narrative didn't exist when she was younger. This is the kind of book she always wanted to read. So here's an excerpt from the beginning of Another Brooklyn.
If we had had jazz, would we have survived differently? If we had known our story was a blues with a refrain running through it, would we have lifted our heads, said to each other, "This is memory," again and again until the living made sense? Where would we be now if we had known there was a melody to our madness? Because even though Sylvia, Angela, Gigi, and I came together like a jazz improv, half notes tentatively moving toward one another until the ensemble found its footing and the music felt like it had always been playing, we didn't have jazz to know this was who we were. We had the top 40 music of the 1970s trying to tell our story. It never quite figured us out.
That is a great setup. Thank you. Jacqueline, what does the title of your book, Another Brooklyn, refer to?
So Another Brooklyn refers to a number of things. First and foremost, it's the Brooklyn of another time. The Bushwick that is on the page here has changed drastically. And it also refers to the girls looking for a way out, exits from their current existence.
So what was that time in Brooklyn then, in the Bushwick neighborhood?
So in the 1970s, there was white flight going on. White folks were moving out to Long Island and Queens, upstate to Westchester. And black and Latino people were moving in through the Great Migration and through immigration. And then it settled into a black and Latino neighborhood that was considered by people on the outside urban, ghetto, slum, whatever the words of that period were. And it was one of the things I wanted to explore in the book was gazing from the inside, because so much of the narrative around that place at that time was an outsider's gaze, and it wasn't our truth.
What was the neighborhood like when you lived there as a kid?
Bushwick was amazing. It was alive. There were people coming back from Vietnam, so there was that kind of change. There was, of course, you know, heroin, because people brought that back from Vietnam, sadly. There were lots of kids in the neighborhood. There was this freedom that we had because everyone really looked out for each other. So there were much fewer cars, so kids played in the streets and it was safe. There was this deep respect for children and children's games and the way children needed to be in the world that I don't feel like exist as much anymore.
Are you nostalgic for your childhood?
For my childhood, I don't want to go back there, but I want it remembered.
Well, in your story, in Another Brooklyn, your narrator, August, meets three girls and they become best friends. And you have a passage where I think it's the moment of introduction, in a way. Mm-hmm. Could you read that?
Mm-hmm. The school bell was ringing. All around us, children were running toward the entrance. Sylvia took my hand. "You belong to us now," she said. And for so many years, it was true. "What did you see in me?" I'd ask years later. "Who did you see standing there?" "You look lost," Gigi whispered. "Lost and beautiful." "And hungry," Angela added. "You looked so hungry." And as we stood half circle in the bright schoolyard, we saw the lost and beautiful and hungry in each of us. We saw home.
So the picture, at least for a good chunk of the book, is it's kind of a beautiful view of childhood, and particularly the friendship among these four girls. I mean, they're all smart and talented, and the world is just full of possibility mm-hmm. ahead of them. How would you describe these girls?
Exactly as you did. When they're with each other, they create this kind of human shield that allows them to be who they are in their world safely.
And this is—and how old are they when they first meet?
When they first meet, they're in grade school, so they're around fifth or sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And when they finally start realizing they're kind of on the edge of adolescence, they begin to realize how much more they need each other, how they need that kind of Bond and Human Shield that they become for each other. At one point, I talk about how boys didn't understand girls together. They understood girls alone, you know, hiding their chest, praying for invisibility. And with each other, they allow themselves to be very visible in the world.
And probably pretty intimidating to those boys.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, if it's worth pointing out that, I mean, you are best known for being a children's book writer. I mean, this one is an adult book, but is there a particular piece of childhood that you want to tell us when you write about children?
I want to talk about all of it. And, you know, at the beginning I say, what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. Because once you start looking back at it from your adult perspective, you start seeing all the kind of fissures in it, right? You start seeing all the places where the veneer begins to crack. But when you're in it, you're not aware of that. You're just aware of the deep joy or the unfairness of being a child in an adult world. And as I was writing it, all of that came flooding back to me, that adult perspective that I had now, and also the deep memories of childhood.
Now, the other thing that happens in your story is as these girls become teenagers, they realize there's also a world of danger out mm-hmm. there. I mean, there are predatory men lurking around. Mm-hmm. There's the fear of pregnancy, which could be disastrous for these girls in particular. Were those big issues for you and your cohort as you were growing up?
Definitely the predators, right? And I think it's the reality of every girl, because our growing up is so visible to the world, right? You see bodies developing, and it's nothing we can hide, and we don't want to hide it, right? We don't want to suddenly wear baggy t-shirts and have that kind of invisibility, because we're also celebrating ourselves as coming into adulthood, and there's this way in which we want to be desired, and so it is that tricky place of balance that as young as adolescent girls, you haven't quite learned yet. In terms of pregnancy, in my crew, I mean, we were some geeky girls, in this way that we knew we weren't going to get pregnant because I think we were too afraid. I was terrified. My mom said, you know, you better not get pregnant.
And you came from a pretty religious family.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. I grew up Jehovah's Witness. But that doesn't mean I wasn't fooling around. but I knew, the line was drawn. If I were to get pregnant as a teenager, my life would be over.
You know, it strikes me that this world that you're describing doesn't tend to get into books. I mean, it's fairly unusual literary terrain. I mean, especially the experience of being a black girl in the 70s mm-hmm. in Brooklyn. I don't know. Are there other stories like that?
Well, now there's a great book by Britt Bennett called The Mothers that explores it in actually present day. But I think of Toni Morrison's Zula, Zora Neale Hurston back in the day. But yeah, this story, I don't think a lot of people are telling it yet. And I think that black girl narrative is so rich, and I didn't grow up reading it. And it's so important to me that I needed to put it on the page.
Do you think people or communities carry history with them? I mean, I don't know. Is there sort of a collective history that's deeply embedded in us that we carry on into the present?
I believe in genetic memory. So,
what do you mean by that?
That stuff that happened to my ancestors is in my DNA. So one thing, my fear of water and people's fear of water, we call the Middle Passage Syndrome, right? Because of the slave trade and coming over and those huge bodies of water and the bottom bowels of these ships and just that fear of open bodies of water and what is on the other side of them or if you're going to make it across. Like, I think as a kid, my mom gave me swimming lessons. You know, if you put me in a pool that's 5 feet deep, I can swim across it 20 times. But if you put me in the ocean, I would probably drown. Like, I just can't. Psychologically, I can't make that connection to how buoyancy works in water because of something that's deeper and older, I think. And I think a lot of, even in writing Brown Girl Dreaming, there is this way in which I feel like every time you sit down to write, the ancestors in the room helping me tell that story. So I definitely, when people don't have a connection to their past, I kind of look askance. I'm like, what happened to it? What is it you're trying to hide or forget?
Jacqueline Woodson, talking with Steve Paulson about her new novel called Another Brooklyn. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tongakar produced this hour, with help from Doug Gordon and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.